this unfathomable genocide might not actually occur. The Lynx might succeed in its mission, but even this slim chance had a dark side. If my lover fails, a world dies, Nara realized. She shook her head. More blood on the hands of Laurent Zai. 10 years earlier, Imperial Absolute. Lieutenant Commander. Laurent Zai dressed quietly, thinking his lover asleep. His arm was clever enough to come to him when he clicked his tongue for it. The limb turned itself slowly, orienting on the sound, then finger-crawled, a bit too quickly for Zai's taste, for a moment a fleshy insect. Supposedly it was smart and agile enough to reach its master even in zero-G, but that was not a feature he had tested. The arm had fallen close to the fire and felt feverishly hot when he meshed its control surface with the tangle of interface threads that hung from his shoulder stump. But the warmth wasn't unpleasant. This house, the fire, Nara, these things were warm and were good. Zai flexed his fingers, their artificial nerves awakening with a tingle like returning blood flow. When a chime assured him of the arm's strength, Laurent pushed himself upright with both hands looking for his legs. They were close by. His remaining natural legs were short stumps, and Zai could sit up easily on them. The floor was soft with some kind of plant growth. It felt like a fine animal pelt, chinchilla or mink. He made his way to the artificial legs with two quick movements, swinging forward like a gymnast on parallel bars. Over the subjective months since his torture, he had exercised his remaining arm until it was almost as strong as the prosthetic one. Vaden's valued balance. He reattached his legs. The smooth grey of their exterior melded with his pale flesh, edges sealing with a familiar tug of suction. He saw his tunic and pulled it over his head as he flexed his toes. Zai turned to see Nara gazing at him. A chill in his chest pushed aside the warmth of the fire, of their love-making. Other than a few medics, none of his crewmates, no one, had ever seen him naked before, much less without his limbs. He tried to say something caustic, but his voice failed him and he scowled. Nara shook her head. I didn't mean to embarrass you. It's your house, he said, pulling on his trousers. When he looked at her again, she seemed puzzled by the words. Take your pleasure as you will, he explained sharply. Have I taken advantage of your nakedness? She said with a small smile. Zai realized that Nara was still completely unclothed. He felt foolish now in his disheveled, fatigued tunic. Grasped some piece of her clothing on the floor and flung it to her. Nara pushed it aside and sat up, reaching for his hand. It was the artificial one, which had somehow lost its glove. She pulled the metal thing toward her breast. Zai's anger faded abruptly. At Nara's touch, he felt safe and whole again, as he had in her arms. Sighing, he closed his eyes and imagined the hand to be real. The returns of the false nerves were very convincing. He opened a second sight menu and increased the hand's sensitivity, basking in the warmth of Nara, the change in texture from dark skin to pink aureole, the slow ripple of her heartbeat. He felt a tremor like distant running water as blood rushed into the erectile tissue of her nipple. He opened his eyes. She was smiling. I'm sorry I snapped at you, Nara. No, Laurent, I should have realized. But you seemed so comfortable before. Eager, more likely. Oh. Was there a note of pity in her voice? A look crossed her face, and she nodded. You don't use... He shook his head. Surrogates, she would have said, but on Vader they used the old words for professionals. The playful smile again. In that case, Laurent, you must be famished. He could not disagree. But Laurent's eye pushed her hands away. He'd felt so broken under her eyes. Nara, he pleaded. Yes, she answered. You can keep your limbs, your tunic too, if you want. He nodded, and a sound came from his chest that was like a sob. But he ignored it, hastening. House. The missive came over the general net, looking for Laurent Zai. The lieutenant commander's presence here at the Polar Estate wasn't registered with the comnets. The mistress had specifically requested privacy, but the search was energetic enough to ping every private domicile on home. Not an emergency, just standard military persistence. The house quietly snatched a copy, investigating its security before passing it on to the mistress's guest. The message bore the telltale marks of mid-level military cryptography. It hadn't been buried under the absolute noise of a one-time pad or the self-similar swirls of fractal compression, so it was neither top secret nor very large. The missive seemed to be double-ticket encryption, with a long enough key that Zai must be carrying it on his person, not in his head. The house set a host of micro-maintenance bots, normally used to repair optical circuitry, to the task of discovering this object. This effort was illegal and against Imperial AI guidelines, but the Rubicon Pale extended around the house whenever Oxum was here. The transgression was also justified by the fact that the house was sometimes called upon to encrypt the mistress's Senate business. And the best way to learn the craft of security was to attack the systems of one's peers. Besides, the house was curious, and the mistress always encouraged it to indulge its curiosity to gather information relentlessly. It was relatively sure she wouldn't mind this bit of harmless snooping. The key was disappointingly easy to discover. A Vaden fetish on a strap around the lieutenant commander's neck proved to be subtly bitmarked. The titanium cladding on its front was brushed to resist fingerprints, and upon close inspection, the tiny ridges of the burnishing were actually sawtooth waves, which reversed direction with suspicious periodicity. The house read the two directions as one and zero, fiddled with the results, and in a few seconds had cracked the missive. It delivered the message to Captain Lawrence Zai. The first half of the message was a promotion, as it absorbed the contents. A new class of ship was described in the missive's second part, an experimental vessel of which Zai would be taking command in a few days. The specifications were not given in great detail, hence the shoddy encryption, but they were certainly stimulating. The warship was officially a frigate, but in the range of its weaponry and ground troops, the Lynx was sui generis. Its design had some of the characteristics of a patrol craft, fast and maneuverable, full of intelligence drones, capable of long-range operation with minimal logistical support. But the frigate also possessed extensive ground attack and orbital insertion capacity, a smattering of heavy weapons, and excellent survivability. It had punch. The house figuratively raised its eyebrows. This was a fine little warship. Perhaps it was intended to serve as a roving ambassador, showing the flag, equipped for crisis management and gunboat diplomacy. As the house expected, the AI component of warship was woefully insufficient for its range of possible operations. Imperial design tended toward underpowered artificial intelligence. The house had recognized long ago that its own distributed processing was at odds with strict Imperial AI regulations. Some sort of damage at the beginning of its existence had allowed it to expand without the usual self-governors. The mistress had always approved, however, as long as it was discreet. There were advantages in being down here at the end of the earth, and it was pleasurable to be illegally smart. The house took care to note Zai's reaction, wondering what he would think of his new ship. Captain Zai and the mistress were together on the western balcony overlooking a few ice sculptures of Aboriginal home insect life that the house had attempted in the dead of winter, smoothed to abstraction now by the arrival of summer. Zai hadn't even accessed the entire missive yet, but he seemed upset by what he had read so far. 10 years out, he said. Was it pain in his voice, or just the cold? 10 years back. The mistress stepped towards Zai, put a hand on his shoulder. He looked at her and laughed sourly, shaking his head. I'm sorry to react this way, he said. You hardly know me, after all. The house scanned the missive and spotted a section it had ignored. The newly promoted captain had been assigned to the Rix Frontier to a system called Legius, 10 light-years away, for a tour of indeterminate length. I'm sorry too, Laurent, the mistress said. Zai placed his hand on hers, blinking from his eyelashes the first flakes of a light snow. He spoke carefully. I know we've just met, but to lose you already... He shook his head. I sound foolish. You don't, Laurent. But I thought I'd be here on home for at least a few months. I was half hoping they'd stick me on training staff. Would you want that, Laurent? A staff position? My ancestors would wail, he answered. But 20 years, and facing the damned time thief again. I suppose I've grown tired of his tricks. How long has it been, Laurent, your career in absolute years? Too many, he said. Almost 100. Nara shook her head. I didn't know. And now another 30, probably, he said. 50, if there really is a war coming. A senator's term of office, the mistress observed. The man turned, his expression changing. You're right, Nara. We may both lose the next 50 years. And you, senators, have your own thief. You're frozen half the time, aren't you? Much more than half, Laurent. Well, he said, meeting her eyes. That's hopeful, I suppose. She smiled. Perhaps it is, but I'll still be older than you, subjectively. I am already.
You are?
She laughed. Yes. Give me another decade in subjective and you'll notice. Zai straightened himself. Of course I will. I'll notice everything. Is that a promise? He took both the mistress's hands. We have 4 days to make promises, Senator-elect. Yes, Captain. 4 days, he repeated and turned back to the ice sculptures. Stay here with me, she asked. Give us those days. The house became alert. The mistress had only announced a weekend stay. Never before had she extended a visit unexpectedly. Meals had been planned in excruciating detail, supplies obtained in exact amounts. Despite the vast resources of the estate, the underground gardens, the caves full of food and wine, the cargo drones ready to launch from 100 high-end stores on the Imperial homeworld, a surge of anxiety almost resembling panic swept through the house's mind. This was all so abrupt. And yet, the house wanted Zai to agree. It waited anxiously for the man's answer. Yes, he said. I'd love to. The house took its attention from their sudden kiss. There was so much to do.
Epilogue. Captain. The links exploded, expanded. The frigate's energy sink manifold spread out, stretching luxuriant across 80 square kilometers. The manifold was part hardware and part field effect. Staggered ranks of tiny machines held in their hexagonal pattern by a lacework of easy gravity. It shimmered in the legious sun, refracting a mad god's spectrum, unfurling like the feathers of some ghostly translucent peacock seeking to rut. In battle, it could disperse 10,000 gigawatts per second, a giant lace fan burning hot enough to blind naked human eyes at 2,000 clicks. The satellite turrets of the ship's 4-photon cannon eased away from the primary hull, extending on hypercarbon scaffolds that reminded Zai of the iron bones of ancient cantilever bridges. The Lynx was shielded from the cannon's collateral radiation by 20 centimeters of hull alloy. They were removed on their spindly arms 4 kilometers from the vessel proper. Using the cannon would afflict the Lynx's crew with only the most treatable of cancers. The 4 satellite turrets carried sufficient reaction mass and intelligence to operate independently if released in battle. And from the safety of a few thousand kilometers distance, their fusion magazines could be ordered to crash fire, consuming themselves in a chain reaction, delivering one final lethal needle toward the enemy. Of course, the cannon could also be crash-fired from their close-in position, destroying their mothership in a blaze of deadly glory. That was one of the frigate's 5 standard methods of self-destruction. The magnetic rail that launched the Lynx's drone complement descended from her belly and telescoped to its full 1,900-meter length. A few large scout drones, a squadron of ramscatters, and a host of sandcasters deployed themselves around the rail. The ramscatters bristled like nervous porcupines with their host of tiny flechettes, each of which carried sufficient fuel to accelerate at 2,000 Gs for almost a second. The sandcasters were bloated with dozens of self-propelled canisters, whose ceramic skins were cross-hatched with fragmentation patterns. At the high relative velocity of this battle, sand would be Azai's most effective weapon against the Rix receiver array. Inside the rail bay, great magazines of other drone types were loaded in a carefully calculated order of battle. Stealth penetrators, broadcast decoys, minesweepers, remotely piloted fighter craft, close-in-defense pickets, all awaited their moment in battle. Finally, a single dead man drone waited. This drone could be launched even if the frigate lost all power, accelerated by highly directional explosives inside its dedicated backup rail. The dead man was already active, continuously updating its copy of the last 2 hours' log files, which it would attempt to deliver to Imperial forces if the Lynx were destroyed. When we are destroyed, Captain Laurent Zai corrected himself. His ship was not likely to survive this encounter. It was best to accept that. The Rix vessel outpowered and outgunned them. Its crew was quicker and more adept, so intimately linked into the battle cruiser's systems that the exact point of division between human and hardware was a subject more for philosophical debate than military consideration. And Rix boarding commandos were deadly. Faster, hardier, more proficient in compromised gravity. And of course, they were unafraid of death. To the Rix, lives lost in battle were no more remarkable than a few brain cells sacrificed to a glass of wine.
Zai watched his bridge crew work, preparing the newly configured links to resume acceleration. They were in zero-G now, waiting for the restructuring to firm up before subjecting the expanded frigate to the stresses of acceleration. It was a relief to be out of high-G, if only for a few hours. When the engagement started in earnest, the ship would go into evasive mode, the direction and strength of acceleration varying continuously. Next to that chaos, the last 2 weeks of steady high acceleration would seem like a pleasure cruise. Captain Zai wondered if there was any mutiny left in his crew. At least two of the conspirators had escaped his and Hobbs's trap. Were there more? The senior officers must realize that this battle was unwinnable. They understood what a Rix battlecruiser was capable of and would recognize that the Lynx's battle configuration had been designed to damage its opponent, not preserve itself. Zai and Exo Hobbs had optimized the ship's offensive weaponry at the expense of its defenses, orienting its entire arsenal on the task of destroying the Rix receiver array. Now that the Lynx was at battle stations, even the junior officers would be able to spot the ill portents that surrounded them. The boarding skiffs remained in their storage cells. It was unlikely that Zai's Marines would be crossing the Gulf to capture the Rix battlecruiser. Boarding actions were the privilege of the winning vessel. Instead, the Imperial Marines were taking up positions throughout the Lynx, ready to defend it from capture should the Rix board the vessel after pounding it into helplessness. Normally, under these conditions, Zai would have issued sidearms to the crew to help repel boarders. But after the mutiny, this seemed a risky show of faith. Most ominously for any crewman who chose to notice, the singularity generator, the most dramatic of Zai's self-destruct options, was already charged to maximum. If the Lynx could draw close enough to the enemy battlecruiser, the two craft would share a dramatic death. In short, the Lynx was primed like an angry, blind drunk hurtling into a bar fight with gritted teeth, ferally anxious to inflict damage, unconscious of any pain she might feel herself. Perhaps that was their one advantage in this fight, Zai thought. Desperation. Would the Rix try to protect the vulnerable receiver array? Their mission was obviously to communicate with the compound mind on Legis, but would the dictates of saving the array force the Rix commander to make a bad move? If so, there might be some slim hope of surviving this battle. Zai sighed and grimly pushed this line of thought aside. Hope was not his ally, he had learned over the last 10 days. He turned his mind back to the bridge airscreen and its detailed schematic of the Lynx's internal structure. The wireframe lines shifted like an oriental puzzle box, as walls and bulkheads inside the frigate slid into battle configuration. Common rooms and mess halls disappeared to make space for expanded gunnery stations. Passageways widened for easier movement of emergency repair teams. Crew bunks transformed into burn beds. The sick bay irised open, consuming the zero-G courts and running tracks that usually surrounded it. Walls sprouted handholds in case of gravity loss, and everything that might come loose in sudden acceleration was stowed, velcroed, bolted down, or simply recycled. Finally, the coiling, shifting, expanding, and extruding all came to a halt, and the schematic eased into a stable shape. Like a well-crafted mechanical bolt smoothly sliding into place, the vessel became battle-ready. A single klaxon sounded. A few of his bridge crew half-turned towards Zai. Their faces were expectant and excited, ready to begin this fight regardless of the ship's chances. He saw it most in Exo Hobbs's expression. They'd been beaten back on Legis 15, all of them, and this was their chance to get revenge. The mutiny, however small and aborted, had shamed them as well. They were ready to fight, and their bloodlust, however desperate, was good to see. It was just possible, Laurent Zai allowed himself to think, that they would get home. The captain nodded to the first pilot, and weight gradually returned, pressing him into the shipmaster's chair as the frigate accelerated. The Lynx moved toward battle. End of The Risen Empire. Succession Book 1 by Scott Westerfeld. S-C-O-T-T W-E-S-T-E-R-F-E-L-D. Read by Steve Douglas Craig. In the studios of Potomac Talking Book Services, Incorporated for the Library of Congress, March 2005. Published by Tor, Tom Doherty Associates, LLC, 175 Fifth Avenue, New York, New York, 10010. Further reproduction or distribution in other than a specialized format is prohibited. If you found any cassette in this book to be defective, please place a rubber band or piece of string around that cassette for identification. Place it in the container on top of the front stack of cassettes.